A doctor tells the following story. She says she was working in a clinic, in her clinic, when one Tuesday morning, 8:15, an old guy walks in, this old man in his 80s walks in, and he needs some treatment, so he's got some stitches in his hand from an accident he had, and he needs the stitches removing. And he says that he's in a rush, and as he waited, he said he had an appointment at 9 o'clock, it was 8:15 now, he said he was in a rush, and as he waited, he was kept checking his watch nervously. And so the doctor decided she would treat him next. And as she took off the bandage, she asked him, said, you know, what were you off to that in such a rush it's so important to you? And he says, I'm going to have breakfast with my wife. I do it every morning. She's in her home. She's been there a few years now, and she's got Alzheimer's. She needs constant care. And as the doctor finished taking out the stitches, she asked the man if his wife would be worried if he was late for breakfast. And he replied quietly, "No, she never will. She hasn't recognized me for 5 years. And the doctor said, you go to her every morning and she doesn't know who you are? And the old man smiled and he put his hand on the doctor's hand and he said, she may not know who I am, but I know who she is and I remember for both of us. Do you wish there was someone who was that devoted to you? Well, there is. Do you wish that you were that devoted to someone else? Well, that is what we are called to. That's the message of this passage in Mark's Gospel that I just read. It speaks of Jesus' devotion to us as his people, and it calls us to respond with devotion to him. The setting is two rather unusual dinner parties. As you'll see in verse 3, if you've got it open, Mark 14, verse 3 and verse 18. Jesus is reclining at table, as they did in those days. At the first dinner party, someone smashes a jar of expensive perfume and pours it over the head of the main guest. And at the second dinner party, the host announces halfway through the meal that his guests are eating his flesh. So two rather unusual dinner parties. Love is in the air, but death is in the air as well. We're in the final days before Jesus' death. And both meals are about broken things. Both meals are about broken things. We've got a broken flask, and we've got a broken body. And both are about devotion. As you'll see on the outline, we'll look firstly at our devotion to Jesus, and then we'll look secondly at his devotion to us. Firstly then, this first dinner party, it's sandwiched between verses about men hatching an ugly plot. You'll see on the outline. So verse 1, it was now 2 days before Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. These annual festivals, they drew huge, huge crowds to Jerusalem. Years later, at the Passover in AD 66, the Jewish historian Josephus, he claimed or he estimated that there were 2.5 million people in the capital for the festival. Now, it's probably a bit of an exaggeration, but it gives some idea of the scale of things at these festivals. And it was a massive security operation. What the authorities feared most was that there would be a Jewish uprising with so many people together, an uprising against the Romans. And so in verse 1, we read the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him, for they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. And so you can imagine their delight when Judas comes forward in verses 10 to 11, because now they've got someone on the inside. So verse 10, then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. One of the 12. No one suspected this guy. Well, he fooled everyone, didn't he, apart from Jesus. No one suspected him. So it wasn't like, you know, Judas looked like some evil monster. He didn't look like some complete freak. He didn't stand out a mile. He was just one of them. He was one of the 12. He looked the part. was close to Jesus, in terms of physically close, but his heart was a million miles away. Verse 11 says, they were glad and promised to give him money, and he sought an opportunity to betray Jesus. The love of money was Judas's downfall. The love of money. So in John chapter 12, verse 6, we read that he was actually a thief. So this guy was the treasurer of the 12. He looked after the money, and he helped himself to what was in the money bag. And his story is a warning to us. It is not enough for us to be hanging around the right circles. You know, we may look the part on the outside, but the question is, where is our heart? Do we love Jesus? Are we devoted to Jesus? Or is our heart elsewhere? So would we betray Jesus for something else? Would we betray him for popularity? Or for a relationship? Or for money? Jesus says in Matthew 6:24, he says, no one can serve two masters. You cannot serve God and money. And so if we do love money, we are betraying Jesus. So Judas is a warning to us. So in verses 1 and 2 and verses 10 to 11, we've got these men who are hatching an ugly plot against Jesus. But sandwiched in between is this woman who does a beautiful thing. And her devotion to Jesus is a very stark contrast to their opposition to him. So often in Mark's account, it is women who are models of faith and devotion. As is often the case in church life and in marriages, it is a challenge to us men to make sure that we step up to the mark. This unnamed woman expresses costly devotion. Have a look at verse 3. While he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly, and she broke the flask and poured it over his head. Very costly it was, they say in verse 5. It was worth 300 denarii, one denarius, a day's wages. So basically we're talking a year's salary. What's the L'Oreal tagline? Because you're worth it. Well, in her eyes, Jesus clearly was worth it. But some who were there, you'll see in verses 4 and 5, they condemn her for what she's done. They rebuked her harshly. They scolded her. They told her off for wasting the money. If we're those who are devoted to Jesus, there will always be those who accuse you of being a fanatic, of being an enthusiast. And they'll urge you to be more moderate. Bit of church going, a bit of belief in Jesus, yeah, that's acceptable. Moderation, that's fine. But being devoted to Jesus, that's taking things too far. It's extreme, it's fanatical, it's unacceptable. When non-Christian parents find out how much money, how much time you give to the work of the gospel, they may be horrified. They may assume that you've got into some cult. When people go into full-time paid ministry, some condemn it, don't they? It's a waste. It's a waste of a good education and career and gifts and so on. But Jesus does not see it that way, not at all. So verse 6, he says, why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing. So in his eyes, what she did, it wasn't a waste, is beautiful. When in verse 8 Jesus says, she has anointed my body beforehand for burial, we don't know if that's just how Jesus saw it or whether that's how she saw it too, the connection with the burial, but her extravagant act, it certainly shows how much she valued Jesus, that he meant everything to her. She did a beautiful thing, and she is a model for us. This outsider, this unnamed woman in the house of a former leper outside Jerusalem. Sometimes true devotion is found where we might least expect it. The last will be first. It looked, didn't it? It looked as if Judas was super committed. He was one of the 12. He was at the heart of the action, had a reputation as one of the 12. But his heart was a million miles away. Whereas this unnamed woman is a model of true devotion. She's done what she could, Jesus says in verse 8. And as he says in verse 9, what she did has now been proclaimed all over the world and even here today. And we are to be like her. We are to do what we can to be devoted to Jesus, to express that in whatever way we can in our own particular context and situations and life circumstances. The more we get who Jesus is, the more we get what he has done for us, the more devoted we will be to him. Nothing will seem too costly for us to do for him. As the psalmist says in Psalm 116, verse 12, he says, "What shall I render to the Lord for all his benefits to me?" The old man going to the care home every morning for breakfast with his wife who doesn't recognize him anymore. Why does he do it? Well, he does it because he loves her. He's devoted to her. Do we not have even more reason to be devoted to Jesus? Well, we certainly do, don't we, when we consider his devotion to us. And that's our second point. What the woman did for Jesus, very costly thing to do. Expensive perfume poured out from this broken flask. But that was nothing compared to what Jesus was about to do for her and for us. His precious blood poured out from a broken body. If what she did, if that was a beautiful thing, how much more so what he would do. His death was no accident. It was very, very deliberate, wasn't it? His devotion in action, according to plan. His loving plan for our salvation. So Jesus wasn't this kind of tragic hero who got caught up in events beyond his control. He knew exactly what would happen, and he was fully in control. And he did it out of devotion to us. We see that, don't we, in the preparations for the Passover meal in verses 12 to 16. So the disciples, they want to know where they should prepare for the Passover meal. And Jesus sends two of them into the city. And he tells them exactly what would happen. That they'd find this man carrying a jar of water. He'd meet them. They were to follow him. And they were to ask where the teacher can eat the Passover. He would show them a large upper room and so on. Verse 16, they found it just as he had told them. Do you remember, just like with the donkey when he entered Jerusalem? Suggests that Jesus had divine foreknowledge of exactly what would happen. Nothing's by chance. It's all according to plan. Now, what was true of those events is true also, isn't it? Even of the events of our lives, that the Lord knows. He's in control. There is a plan. It's being worked out. Even if things look chaotic to us, it's a bit like we're looking at a sweater, a jumper that's been turned inside out. And to us, it seems a chaotic mess, doesn't it? But from the other side, from God's side, there is this intricate, beautiful pattern and design. And that should give us great comfort, especially when, from our perspective, it seems like the wheels are falling off and everything's going wrong. Sometimes when I'm sitting at my desk in my study, a sparrow will come and sit on the windowsill. And it always makes me think of Jesus' words in Matthew 10:29. Remember, he's speaking about sparrows and he says, "Not one of them will fall to the ground apart from my Father." That is, from the will of my Father. So if even the death of one of these sparrows, if even that is not outside God's will, it's according to his plan, how much more so our lives, even the details of our lives as his children. Nothing is left to chance. God's sovereignty, his providence is, as someone has said, it is a pillow on which we are to lay our heads. This knowledge of the Lord, this control of the Lord comes across even more clearly, doesn't it, in verses 17 to 21. When Jesus arrives with the 12 and they start the Passover meal, verse 18, Jesus said, Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me. And verse 20, he says, it is one of the 12, one who is dipping bread into the dish with me. Jesus knew. And it's not because he'd overheard some conversation, but I presume it's because he's the Son of God. He knew it all beforehand. It was all planned out. Indeed, the scriptures foretold that the Christ would be betrayed by a close friend. We had it in our first reading in Psalm 55, verse 12, where David said, it's not an enemy who taunts me, then I could bear it, but it's you, my companion, my familiar friend. So Judas's betrayal was foretold. It was according to God's plan. But Judas was also responsible for his actions, his evil actions. So back in Mark here in verse 21, Jesus says, for the Son of Man goes as is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. You ever been betrayed by someone close to you? Perhaps someone at work, someone in your team, maybe stabbed you in the back. Perhaps even by your spouse. Must be devastating, but how agonizing if you knew beforehand that was going to happen. If you knew all along. Well, Jesus did. Jesus knew all along, didn't he? He knew that Judas was a thief. He knew that he would betray him. 3 years together, doing ministry, this tight-knit group, Jesus knew all along, but Jesus went through with it because of his devotion to us. Because his betrayal, his death, that was the price of our salvation. Because his death would be a rescuing sacrifice. The timing of his death, it was no accident, was it? It was very, very deliberate. The timing of his death. So the authorities, as we've seen, they did not want Jesus killed at the Passover. They wanted it to happen afterwards and in secret. But God had other ideas, and nothing could stop God's plan. The death of Jesus would be right in the middle of this biggest feast, and it would be in public. The Passover timing is emphasized repeatedly, isn't it, in this account? So Passover is mentioned in verse 1, verse 12, verse 14, verse 16. Why? Why did God choose this time of year, this particular day, for the death of Jesus? Well, he did it to flag up that there is a link between the two. The Passover explains the significance of Jesus' death. The Passover is the context for his death. It is the context for understanding why he died. He would die as the ultimate Passover sacrifice. Passover, one of the biggest, greatest annual pilgrimages in Jerusalem, it celebrated God's rescue of his Old Testament people from Egypt. So you remember that they had been slaves, hadn't they, under cruel masters in Egypt. And the Lord came in judgment one night on their enemies and to save his people. But to be saved, what did each household have to do? They had to take a lamb and they had to slaughter it. And they put the blood of the lamb around the door of their house and they ate the lamb inside in the meal. And the Lord then passed over that house when he saw the blood, and that house was spared from judgment. And every year since that first Passover, God's people were to celebrate this great rescue with a Passover festival. They sacrificed a lamb in the temple, and then they ate it in their homes, giving thanks for God's rescue of them from slavery and judgment. And so the point of Jesus dying at Passover was to make this connection clear, that he is the Passover lamb. 1 Corinthians 5 verse 7 says, Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. So through his death, we enjoy the ultimate rescue from slavery to sin. And his blood protects us from judgment. Through trusting in him, we are saved. that Jesus is himself the Passover sacrifice is pretty clear as well, isn't it, in what he says to his disciples as he reclined there at table at the Passover meal, at this Last Supper. So this is on the Thursday night, so the night before he died. He explains that the Passover meal is all about him, that he is the focus of it. So look at verse 22. And as they were eating, he took bread, and after blessing it, he broke it and gave it to them and said, "Take, this is my body." So the broken bread symbolized his body, which would be broken in his flogging and his crucifixion. Verse 23, he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank of it, and he said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many." So the wine symbolized his blood poured out to establish the new covenant. What devotion! Jesus sacrificing himself for them and for us. And that past meal has now become a present meal. So the Last Supper has become the Lord's Supper. So what Jesus did on that Thursday evening was not just a one-off, it was instituting something new. And that's clear in Luke's account of this, where Jesus says, "Do this in remembrance of me." That's Luke 22:19. And that then became the practice of the early church, remembering the death of Jesus by sharing bread and wine, as we see in 1 Corinthians 11:17 to 32, for example. So instead of looking back to the Passover rescue under Moses, Christians were now to look back to the death of Jesus, which fulfilled it. In the story of the old man visiting his wife with dementia, which of the two do you identify with most? Spiritually, the danger is that we become like the wife who no longer recognizes her husband. That's the spiritual danger, that we forget who he is and we forget what he's done for us. There is a spiritual dementia. But the Lord's Supper is given us to keep us from that, so that we won't forget, so that we will remember. And not just remember him, but also feed on him. Not literally feed on him, so the bread, the wine, they don't actually become his body and blood, so contrary to what the Roman Catholic Church claims. Eating the bread, drinking the wine is a powerful picture. It's a picture of receiving personally what Jesus did as being for me, trusting personally. And then just as eating physical food, physical drink, it strengthens our physical bodies, so this spiritual food, this spiritual drink, it strengthens our souls. So the present meal, this present meal, it looks back to what Jesus has done for us, but it also looks forward to the future meal. So verse 25, "Truly I say to you, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." So when Jesus returns, there will be this ultimate feast with his people in the kingdom of God, the messianic banquet, the wedding banquet. One of the gods, the mythical gods that the Romans believed in, was called Janus. And he was a two-faced god, so he looked in two directions at the same time. He looked backwards and forwards. And of course, it's from his name that we get the month January, so a time of looking backwards and looking ahead as well. As Christians, we need to be looking in both directions at the same time. So not just in January, but all the time. Looking back to what Christ has done for us and looking ahead to his return. And that is why at the end of every Lord's Supper, we declare, don't we, Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again. We're not just looking back, we're looking forward as well. As Paul says, 1 Corinthians 11:26, he says, "As often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." So our theme today has been devotion. Where does it leave us as we close? If you're someone who's exploring the big questions of life, I wonder what you make of all of this. Richard Dawkins, he famously wrote, didn't he? He said that the universe we observe has precisely the properties we would expect. If there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. Well, what we've observed in today's passage is a very, very different view of life, a very different view of the world. So rather than no design and no purpose, instead we've seen evidence of a carefully planned and a carefully executed divine rescue operation. And rather than pitiless indifference, we've seen evidence of a God who loves us so much that in Christ he came to sacrifice himself for our salvation. Not indifference, but devotion. And for those of us who do believe this, how would we describe our relationship with Christ? Do we believe in him? Do we trust in him? Do we follow him? Are we devoted to him? Would we say that? Are we devoted to him? So are we like the woman with her expensive perfume? Or are we maybe a bit more like those who are looking on and who think that that kind of extravagant devotion is distasteful, it's wasteful, it's over the top? Increasingly you see this, don't you? You see cars are parked by lampposts with their charging leads plugged in. Where do we plug in if we're aware that our devotion levels to Jesus are low? Where do we plug in? Well, we plug in, don't we? Not at a lamppost, but at the cross. It's where we see Jesus' devotion to us. And that is, if you like, the recharging post for our devotion to him, as we contemplate his devotion to us. The beautiful thing that he did. And that is where we find forgiveness for our own coldness and indifference. Well, if anyone was devoted to Jesus, it was surely the Apostle Paul. What a model of devotion to Jesus Paul was. Where did it come from? I think we get a clue, don't we, in Galatians 2, verse 20, when he writes in wonder and in astonishment. He says, "The Son of God loved me, and he gave himself for me."